I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning into episode 221 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen Tuesdays at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Speaking of phone numbers and following the instructions, prn.fm has voicemail. Call 862-800-6805. Leave a message for the show. Leave your name and make sure you indicate that the question is for The Infectious Myth, question or comment. If you dial either of these numbers, remember that long-distance charges may apply. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you. Send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I made by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from my listeners, so don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to cover the expenses of the show via PayPal using the email david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And new this episode, If the monthly donations, which are very small, grow to the point where they more than cover our expenses, then I will send half of the surplus to a worthy guest, for example, Jeff Deskovich's foundation, to deal with the wrongly convicted. That would be a good way that we could help some of the people I interview who are struggling to get by with an organization that has very little money. If you'd like me to speak at the meeting of an organization you're a member of, and on any topic that you think I have an interesting and worthwhile opinion on, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now let's go to this week's interview, which is actually more like a discussion than normal. Maria McGuire has been active in the LGBT movement since 1997. A queer feminist, she was deeply influenced by lesbian culture. She grew up near Los Angeles and now lives in Mexico, where she helps middle and high school students online with algebra and geometry at the website candomath.com. She contacted me because she wasn't happy with my approach to transgender issues, so I offered for her to come on my show to have a discussion, and I'm pleased that she accepted. So this will be a little bit different than normal. It's not really an interview, it's a discussion, and we will walk through some of the controversial transgender issues. Maybe all the issues are controversial. So welcome to the show, Maria.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
Yeah, so what is your story of coming out as lesbian? You said since 1997, maybe before then. You say you've been active since then.
Yeah, I came out when I was 18 in 1997. And I've been part of the LGBT movement ever since.
When and why did you move to Mexico?
I originally moved here in 2005. That was for an internship in Mexico City. And then I stayed and I taught English. And I really loved it and I always missed it. I came back because I wanted to teach public. I came back to the U.S. I'm American. I wanted to teach public school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that for about a decade, and then I decided I no longer wanted to be a school teacher, and kind of thought about what I wanted to do, and I saw no reason to continue living in the U.S., and Mexico was close, and that's where I am now.
Yeah, Okay, so in your life and work in the LGBT community, how did you, I mean, when did you start to meet transgender people, and you know, what kinds of interactions did you have, and how did that form your approach to the issue?
Yeah, it was really gradual. I went to a women's college, and a couple of my friends near the end and then after college came out as transgender men. I met a lot of genderqueer people, non-binary people. I took a queer theory class in college, and that gave me a lot of reading to do. I worked, I volunteered with GLSEN, Gay and Lesbian Straight Education Network, and I met parents of transgender children. And just, yeah, socially, I've probably met thousands of transgender people in my life.
Okay, well, let's start to go through the list of issues that I put together. One of the, what you might even call a battlegrounds, has been over words. And so perhaps the most neutral word for a man who's transitioning to live as a woman is transgender woman. But now some people are saying transgender women are literally women, whereas other people on the other side are saying they're just men who are living as women, or men under a delusion. So, I mean, I prefer the term transgender woman, but what's your position on this wording?
Yeah, I've never heard anybody claim that transgender women are literally women. I mean, that's a word I use when somebody tells me they're a transgender woman, but I think it's still important to remember the difference between, you know, biologically male or female versus what identity somebody has and the experiences we have in the society. So yeah, the difference between sex and gender is something that I keep, even though that's kind of going away nowadays, and people tend to use male and female to mean what I think of the words male and female as having a biological connotation, but that seems to be changing. So, and I think even though it is a blurry distinction, because there are intersex people and there are non-binary people, I think it's still important to remember, you know, the concept of biologically male, biologically female, that is relevant.
Yes, I read an article about a transgender man who was in hospital, and because they had been recorded as a man, nobody thought about the possibility that they might be pregnant. And that caused complications when she started to give birth. Started to give birth. It's hard to talk about a man giving birth. But because of this insistence that the person be recorded as a man, caused some issues, because the, you know, in a hospital, they obviously deal with biology. And I have seen quite a bit online of saying that transgender women literally are women, but that might be because people who oppose the transgender ideology, if you can call it that, are more likely to pick up these extreme viewpoints and amplify them.
The words man and woman, man and woman, men and women, girl and boy, those to me have a connotation of gender. And so I try to respect that. But yeah, I think hospitals need to get better organized so they don't run into problems like.
Well, another thing that's come out in the last few days is in several states, there seems to be competition in the so-called red states like Alabama, Mississippi, Missouri, to come out with the most extreme anti-abortion laws possible. you know, including no exemptions for rape or incest. So I think there is an 11-year-old girl, I think in Ohio or Iowa, who was raped by an uncle who's now pregnant, who under these laws might not be eligible for an abortion. But some transgender activists have insisted that this include not just women, but men, because after all, a transgender man could get pregnant. But that seems to confuse the issue of, to me, of a very biological function of being pregnant and having a baby. And, you know, an abortion is a procedure that only occurs on biological females. I was asking you if you'd heard any transgender people objecting to discussing abortion as a woman's issue. That was really the objection.
I have not, but I have heard language change to like people who are pregnant and things like that. So I assume that that's what's behind it.
I've definitely heard people coming up with what seemed like rather cumbersome expressions to avoid talking about pregnant women. But my opinion is we need words for biology and people's gender, which is influenced by their feelings about themselves, is something different. But if we get rid of, you know, biological sex related words, we're going to end up with some very, very cumbersome conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we definitely shouldn't get rid of the biological language. I guess it is easier to say pregnant women than, well, no, pregnant people is the same number of words. So.
I mean, there could be cases like we managed to get our heads around things like the word or the term Ms. instead of Miss or Mrs.
Not in this country. I hope they have in Canada.
Yes.
But yeah,
yes.
Ms. is simpler. So, and
that right. Yes, but I have seen some pretty cumbersome, like 3 or 4 words to describe, say, pregnant women, or which can make conversations rather cumbersome. One of my concerns about changes, because I think transgender issues have risen to the fore and have changed a lot, or the discussion has changed a lot in just the last 3 or 4 years. There's now transitioning of through cross-sex hormones of very young children. There's an American study funded by the National Institute of Health, which reduced their entry criteria from 13 years to 8 years. And they actually do have children in the study who are being transitioned at that age. And my understanding is that this will render them sterile. So if they do change their minds, they're not actually going to be able to go back to where they were before they started.
Yeah, that seems far, far too young. I have never heard any transgender adults argue that children should go on hormones at such a young age. And it kind of makes me wonder about informed consent, because they're so young. Can they really consent to that?
There's a YouTube video, if it's still up, of a woman surgeon who works at the big Los Angeles transgender clinic. And she talked about this boy who was transitioning to a girl. And she said a couple of things that I found a little bit disturbing. The first is that she had rendered him sterile through hormones. I had heard before that this is all reversible, but if they're talking about somebody being sterile, and obviously it's not reversible. And secondly, she justified her desire to remove his testes by saying that because we've rendered him sterile, and because medicine doesn't like to remove functional organs, these are non-functional organs, therefore they can be removed without ethical problems. Mm-hmm. I was kind of shocked at that.
Yeah, that is disturbing. Was that a doctor or a person from the LGBT community?
It was a surgeon. A woman's
surgeon. That's right, that's what you said.
Yes, and I mean, that made it, I could see that transgender activists could say this without maybe having the biological knowledge of what this is, but to have a surgeon say that seemed to me like she was just so excited about doing all of this surgery that she'd kind of forgotten the person who was involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's disturbing. That sounds a little overly zealous. I'm not sure what word to use, but yeah, when I listen to transgender adults, their last concern is trying to get, surgery or hormonal transitions to children. That's not what they're worried about.
What are the concerns of adult transgender people that you've run into?
Well, they had a difficult adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
And as a former teacher, I don't like to see students dropping out of school. A lot of them ran away as teenagers, and those that didn't still suffered a lot of bullying and discrimination when they were younger. And so what I hear them saying is that, safety from violence, freedom from discrimination is what's most important to them.
Yes, well, that's understandable. Children can be very cruel, and anybody who violates the norms, whether that's a girl who is always playing games and dressing like a boy, or whether it's a boy who is more effeminate, whether they're transgender or gay, or maybe neither, maybe just they're heterosexual, but they have interests that don't conform with the strict rules we put on on gender.
Yeah, definitely.
Another thing that has been mentioned quite a bit is that a lot of these youths, and you kind of alluded to this, have a lot of other problems, home problems, psychological problems. A lot are dealing with ADHD or autism, eating disorders, self-harm, etc. I mean, has that been your experience too?
Well, I remember talking to one woman. I worked one parent of a transgender child that I worked with through GLSEN, and she told me about one young girl, one transgender girl that she met, and she had so many problems and was put on all these medications for, anxiety, and I don't remember what the diagnoses were, but then she was allowed a social transition to live as a girl. And then all of the diagnoses went away and she was just so much healthier and she didn't have to be on the medication anymore. But they do face a lot of difficulties, and just, you're right, just, being a teenager, being an adolescent can be, it's difficult enough.
Yeah, I don't think there are too many adolescents who aren't all torn up inside by something, but obviously for some it's a lot worse than others. And even adolescents who are heterosexual, who don't strain too much at what are perceived as gender norms, have psychological stresses. It's part of growing up, but it's a lot worse if you're violating those norms somehow.
Yeah, definitely.
Behaving differently. But I was reading a paper on what's called a body dysmorphic disorder. They have millions of these disorders. Mm-hmm. This seems to have some correlations with gender dysphoria, but I was a bit surprised at what they were saying. But they said that cosmetic surgeons have observed that certain people who are dealing with a lot of psychological issues will sort of focus on the cosmetic change. They will say that, their breasts are too small, or their nose is wrong, or something like that. And that they've discovered that if the surgery is done, the underlying changes don't change. And that's different than the experience you noted. And that they don't want to do surgery on these people, because often the patient will turn around and attack the surgeon, either with words or in some cases even physically. Yeah. So I was just going to ask you if you've seen places where, you know, maybe some of the other issues should be dealt with first rather than focusing on transitioning the body to a different sex.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Yeah, when I listen to transgender friends of mine, I don't hear that much talk about surgery. In fact, you know, a lot of transgender people don't want to get surgery and don't have any desire to, or they may want a different body, but like thinking about it realistically, they decide that they're just, you know, not gonna go through the surgery. Yeah, I guess it's not something I really know that much about, because that's just not what I hear transgender people talking about. It's more about overcoming discrimination and being included in the public sphere.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there's a lot of focus on surgical transitions, but you're right that most transgender people, at least as adults, don't want them. One of my concerns is that they're being suggested for children who maybe aren't mature enough to really understand the lifetime consequences of having their breasts removed or having their testes removed or whatever it is that are going to be suggested.
Yeah, that's too young.
Yes. And then maybe also not understanding that, you know, what a surgeon can do amazing things with the body, but they cannot actually produce the genitalia of the opposite sex. They can produce a simulation of that at best.
Yeah, I think my understanding is that they're getting a lot better than they used to be, but yeah, of course. I don't know that much about that.
Yes. I don't know if they've talked to you about hormones, but there are a considerable number of side effects to long-term use of hormones, such as heart disease and things like that. And so even, you know, though adults are perfectly, you know, entitled to have surgeries unnecessary, I mean, that's the very definition of cosmetic surgery. In the case of hormones, I wonder if the psychological benefits are being properly weighed against the physical health consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And that's why I think we need to create a society where you can be transgender and you don't have to be on hormones if you make that decision. I remember back in the late 90s, a lot of women's spaces would say that a transgender woman would have to have like completed her transition, meaning like everything, including genital surgery. And that just, I'm glad that's not the norm anymore, because it's really kind of cruel, and it's really not any of our business.
Yeah, that's one of my concerns. We might talk about sports later, but the idea that to run as a woman you might need to take hormones to me is pushing people into taking drugs that could have consequences that result in later disability or an early death, which is and that would be the same encouraging sort of pushing people towards a physical transition in order to properly live as the opposite gender would seem to be dangerous.
Yeah, and then just like the bigger issue of steroids, a lot of athletes taking steroids in sports, that's its own issue to start with.
Right. I mean, to me,
there's harmful as well. Yeah.
To me, there's two reasons athletes shouldn't be allowed to take drugs. The first is obviously that it gives them an unfair advantage. But the second is that, you know, an 18 or 20 year old is going to, you know, who really wants to win is going to take drugs that when they're 30 or 40 could cause an early death or could cause major psychological or physical harm. To allow taking of those drugs is to essentially coerce athletes into taking those drugs. And so
that they can be competitive, yeah.
Right, because if drugs were allowed, then everybody would have to take steroids. And so then all the athletes would be experiencing these consequences. You alluded to access to protected women's spaces. So we have bathrooms, change rooms, domestic violence shelters, women's prisons. Those are places where only women are allowed. But now transgender women are in some cases able to access those spaces. There have been some cases where men with a history of sexual abuse of women have declared themselves transgender women. What is the balance between allowing access to these spaces and ensuring that people who are abusive to women don't get access to them?
Well, I think there's two things. There's private women's only spaces, and then there's public women's spaces like bathrooms and prisons and changing rooms. As far as private women's spaces, like groups, those decisions are made collectively, or they should be, by that group. But as far as public spaces, violence is, the issue that we're worried about is violence, and the question is, how do we prevent violence and how do we hold those who are violent accountable?
It's not easy. Like, if I can give you a couple of examples, in Vancouver in Canada, the longest serving rape crisis center was barred from receiving city funding because they insisted on serving only biological women in their shelter. Not some of their services were open to transgender women as well, but they insisted in their shelter it be only biological women.
In Tucson, I lived for a good decade in Southern Arizona and Tucson, and they Emerge, which was their big domestic violence shelter. They're open to all. They don't have a biological women only rule. And as far as I know, it has worked because the vast majority of their clients are biological women.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that's fair that they'd be barred from city funding because it's tax supported and everybody pays their taxes. And I think when we, run into the problem of violence, that's the question. How do we deal with violence? Because cisgender women can also be violent, even though I know not as that high
much,
of a rate.
Right, to a much lower level.
Yeah, I think we also have to ask the question of, why are women's spaces necessary and popular? Because and I'm sort of a hypocrite because I am a fan of women's spaces and I do use them. I ride the subway and I go in the women-only cars, and then there's always one man who has to be in the women's-only car, and that really annoys me. But it's we shouldn't have women-only spaces when I think about it. They shouldn't be necessary because, ideally, men would change their behavior and good men would, keep the more violent or more obnoxious men in line so that women-only spaces were not necessary. In an ideal world, we wouldn't have women-only spaces.
Yes. The problem, I think, is when men are alone. I would like to think that if I was around a man who was being obnoxious, physically or verbally obnoxious to women, that I would mm-hmm. do something. But I think a lot of those men take advantage of times when there aren't people around and can corner a woman and abuse a woman just from their larger size.
Mm-hmm.
What I was going to say in the Vancouver case, on the other side, there was a Canadian, also in the same part of Canada, a women's shelter that did allow transgender women, and they asked this biological woman to share a bedroom with a transgender woman, which traumatized the woman who had been abused by a man. And she was told that she would have to leave, not the transgender woman, which basically denied a woman access to a shelter. And in Toronto, Yeah, in Toronto, there was a case of a man, which the newspaper described as falsely claiming to be a transgender woman, who was in a woman's shelter and sexually abused two women inside the shelter. So there have been some of these isolated cases where access to protected women's spaces has resulted in problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does seem insensitive to the woman who was traumatized. And as you said, those are isolated incidences and they're not common at all. Personally, I don't have any problem with penises. I do identify as a woman, as a cis woman. I don't think of my vagina and my ovaries as, that's not what defined me as a woman. It's my experiences in this world. But then again, it's, you know, I've never been traumatized by a rape. So, I guess I'm not in the place to tell other women, you shouldn't be traumatized by the existence of a penis. You should feel safe.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's understandable that a woman who has experienced maybe years of abuse at the hands of a partner and has finally left, would see the male body as a potential threat. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, after some time, she could gain more balance. But certainly at that moment of vulnerability, after she's maybe mm-hmm. had the difficult decision to leave a relationship and all the financial consequences. I mean, do you feel men are definitely bigger than women on average? So, I mean, have there been times when you've kind of felt intimidated because you're dealing with a man who's twice your size and maybe is being a bit aggressive, and even if not, you know, actually touching you or whatever, just sort of getting a feeling of intimidation?
Personally, no, I never have. I would definitely be intimidated if they had a weapon.
Yes.
I remember once when I had short hair and, you know, wearing quote unquote men's clothing, and it was dusk and I was walking home and this elderly woman, you know, saw me and then like scurried away as if I had scared her. She probably thought I was a young man. But no, I'm not. I've never been intimidated by a man's stature. But as you know, like predatory men are cowards, and they probably go after women who are, you know, an easier, someone, you know, significantly smaller than them. And since I probably look stronger and taller than the average women, that's probably why I'm not. Haven't been targeted.
I mean, I guess that's the part of predatory behavior is finding somebody who's vulnerable, who's alone, you know, who's smaller. All of those things. I'm mm-hmm. sure that goes through the mind of a man who's trying to do something bad to a woman. Mm-hmm. One of the criticisms of modern transgender ideology is that it reinforces the gender binary. In other words, if a man says, I'm going to become a woman, that's very different than discussion of non-binary, where a man says, I'm not fully a man, I'm not going to follow the, you know, the book about what men should be. I'm not necessarily going to dress like a man or behave like a man. But in this idea of transitioning from man to woman, it's sort of in saying there is a binary and you can be one or the other and you can change, but it kind of erases the in-between that non-binary was talking about. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. But I have met so many transgender people who have, who, you know, are such great feminists in the good sense of the word, who do challenge the binary. And I guess you did say you're not talking about non-binary people, but even, you know, transgender people who identify as transgender women, transgender men, they also, you know, challenge what we see as masculine, challenge what we see as feminine. And I've learned a lot from them. But I do think it's important to distinguish between gender expression, gender identity, and there is like a gray, there's a blurry line between them, but there's a difference between feminine, masculine, and man and woman. Like a man can be feminine, a woman can be masculine, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, my opinion is that we sort of had idealized these very rigid gender roles. And, you know, 100 years ago, there were lots of things women couldn't be. Like women's jobs were, if you weren't going to be a wife and mother, it was like nun, prostitute, teacher were like your options. I think we're in a better place now. But there's still some kinds of feeling like that's a man's job, you know. A surprise of seeing a woman get in the cockpit of a plane is almost gone away. But I think there's still some element of, oh, really, a woman pilot? It's not totally normal and accepted yet, but we're getting there, I guess.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. And sometimes, like, especially when I was younger, I was like, why do you have to be transgender? Why don't you just be like a masculine woman or a feminine man? But that also feels kind of judgmental. Like, I've never been in their shoes. I don't know what they feel like. And so who am I to judge? And it's like girl and woman have always been terms that resonated with me. But that's just my experience.
There has been some discussion, you brought it up, that instead of encouraging children to explore their sexuality in such as, you know, a boy who says, I feel like more like a woman, to open the discussion of, you know, maybe you're gay, maybe you're a heterosexual man who just has feminine qualities, and that's fine, or maybe you're transgender. Are we sort of pushing people towards the transgender when maybe after some time they'll realize that they're just gay?
Yeah. I mean, I hope we're not, but I think we really need to focus on respecting people's autonomy, and people know themselves better than anybody else knows them. I think, especially in American culture, there's a harmful aspect of our culture. I don't know what you think about Canadian culture, but like, we love to tell people what they should do and what they should think or how they should feel. And I just hate that. And yeah, we shouldn't, you know, push people towards being transgender if they're not. There was one, you mentioned the degenderettes, so I read up on them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There was one quote that I read that they shared, and it said, experimenting with your gender only to find out you're cis is totally okay. Cis people questioning their gender helps normalize gender exploration. So I think that's an example of transgender people not pushing everybody to be transgender.
Right. I mean, I have also read statements by people, young people mainly, who've detransitioned, who went through several years of moving towards transgender and then decided that that wasn't right for them, who said that they felt that their support network went away, that it wasn't possible to talk to people about their feelings because everybody had been on board. You know, you're going to be transgender somewhere down the road, you're going to get confirming surgery, et cetera, et cetera. And that when they transitioned, they had a feeling they were being treated like a traitor to the cause.
Oh, that's terrible. Is that, so that was not the medical community, but the transgender community?
Yes. I think it was everything. It was like they had built up the support network, which included medical people, with everybody sort of saying, yes, you're brave, you're coming out, this is where you're going. But when they sort of said, no, I don't want to go ahead with stop the hormones, I don't want to have the surgery, I want to live, say, as a gay man or woman, they felt that those people they couldn't talk to anymore.
That's terrible. I've never heard of anything like that. That's unlike what I've heard. I know. I mean, so many transgender people have gay and lesbian friends, and we're all different but part of the same community. And I think, that's terrible to know that there are people like that. When you're coming out as gay or lesbian or bi or transgender, I think it's, to anybody listening, it's really important to try and meet a lot of different people, because not everyone who's LGBT is a good person. So really try and meet as many people as you can, and then decide who's got your back, who really accepts you for you, gives you unconditional love, and really don't just go in with the first crowd you find.
Yeah, I guess there is a tendency that if you sort of make a bold decision and then you back off on it, that there's this sort of feeling of disappointment, even though it's the best thing for you. But if people really support you, they should support you in that decision as well.
Yeah, that's so strange, and that's sad to hear that that's some people's experience.
Yes. There was a psychiatrist in Canada who lost his job because he was advocating basically a go slow approach to children with gender dysphoria and not rushing into hormones and things like that. And he said that a lot of these things resolve and the child ends up becoming comfortable with their born gender and deciding eventually that in many cases, not all, that living as transgender is not necessary. But that was considered, he was accused of gay conversion therapy, that he was confused of doing the opposite of what he was actually doing, of actually pushing children away from transitioning. But as more information came out, it was clear that what he was doing was just trying to listen to these children, deal with their issues, discuss, you know, what their gender was, and let them sort of evolve into what hopefully is the right path.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know that story. That sounds
His name is Zucker, Z-U-C-K-E-R. He's still active, but he was the head of a large organization in Toronto, and he got fired for it. And then, of course, won a settlement when more information came out, but that's sort of typical.
Wow. Well, I mean, social transition, I think when a child says that they want to live as another gender and, you know, change their name from Tom to Sarah, we should honor that. That's harmless. But yeah, definitely advocating a slow approach to physical transition or hormonal transition, that sounds prudent.
Yes. I mean, especially given that no matter what sex or gender you are, if you're pre-pubertal, you actually don't know what it's like to be a sexually functioning adult. And I guess for some people, the thought of being a sexual man or woman is disturbing, but probably to most children, the thought of, like, their parents having sex is probably disturbing.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely remember I did not want to start going through puberty, but it happens.
Yes, and I guess especially for a girl, when you start menstruating, your breasts start growing, but they're either too small or whatever, right? Like there's maybe more for a woman than for a man in terms of the psychological impact of puberty. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I think we've come close to the end of this list of things. One thing I wanted to talk about a little bit was the difference between transgender and intersex. I was investigating Castor Semenya, who's an intersex woman who's also right now pretty much the fastest woman runner in the world. Mm-hmm. And some people are actually calling her a man because she has XY chromosomes. And I discovered, I hadn't really investigated this a lot, that there's also men who have XX chromosomes. So in other words, a man with a penis and testicles who actually has female chromosomes, and like Castor Semenya with male chromosomes, who's actually a woman. And although this is really quite a different thing, because it's certainly not the choice, or, you know, it's not, you know, you're born this way, you know, physically born this way, as opposed to having a feeling that something's wrong with your gender. It does raise these issues of exactly what is a woman and what is a man, and mm-hmm. how, what is the gray area between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I used to think that testosterone was a good measure, but her case shows how it's not. I mean, nature produces intersex people. It's depending on how you define male versus female. It can be up to 4% of the population, from what I've read. And I think it really depends on the sport, because in some sports, higher testosterone gives you a distinct advantage, and in, you know, billiards, I don't think it gives you much of an advantage.
Right. I mean, one of the points people have made is that every athlete, almost by definition, has an advantage. Like, they're born mm-hmm. taller or stronger or with faster reactions. I mean, if you're not born with some physical advantages, then you're probably not going to be a great athlete. But of course, that's not enough to make you a great athlete. You also have to have drive and determination, good training, and all of those
mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. And there's sports people. I mean, like, there's two types of sports. There's sports we participate in for fun, and then there's elite competition. And when we're just playing sports for fun, in that case, it doesn't really matter. But when this is somebody's lifelong dream, then yeah, like, this is an important issue.
Yeah, one thing, there was one article that specifically called her a man. They didn't quite do that. They called her a male. They were trying to soften the blow. But they basically said Castor Semenya should not be running because that's destroying women's sports. And they put an interesting graph of 400-meter races. And they showed that in 2017, something like 2,000 men had run faster times than the fastest women in the world. And that the difference for the 400 meters is something like 5 seconds. So the fastest mm-hmm. man in the world is like 5 seconds faster than the fastest woman. Mm-hmm. But they didn't put Castor Semenya on the graph. And the reason I think they didn't do that is because Castor Semenya is a bit slower than the fastest women in the world. So that would mean that in the 400 meters, there's about 2,000 men in 1 year who will run faster than her, which mm-hmm. also means that if she's forced to run as a man, she would have difficulty running, winning at an elite high school, let alone mm-hmm. In the Olympics. So it would completely destroy her career.
Okay. I see your point.
So, I guess what I'm saying is she's running a time that is concordant with an elite woman. And, mm-hmm. You know, it's again, we get back to biology. It's, you know, strength is not everything, and it doesn't make men better than women. But when it comes to elite athletes, elite athletics, in most sports, men have a tremendous advantage. But as mm-hmm. I think with intersex athletes, they are in the upper range of women, not in the range of men.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
Well, on the topic of sports, before
no, in any area, not just sports.
Yeah. Let me think about it. I think we need to remember that for some sports, they already have four categories, and people seem to love categories. So it's not like it would be like some outrage if we added another category. I used to, when I was in college, I did crew, and they had, lightweight women, heavyweight women, lightweight men, heavyweight men. So it's not as if we're opposed to categories, and, nature doesn't have a clear line between male and female. So there's not really any reason why we can't add another category.
I think the problem with that is that intersex is like itself a huge spectrum. There's the majority who fit well within male and female, but when it comes to intersex, it's like there are many intersex women who have female chromosomes, but they have some physical abnormalities that's more like a man. So it's not like there is a single group like Castor Semenya. There's multiple different abnormalities that can occur, each with their own impact on performance.
Yeah, I think each sport should, democratically decide like how they're going to define their categories. And
I guess they're trying to do that. I've a feeling that the IAAF decision that told Castor Semenya she can only run if she reduces her testosterone is not going to be the final word. But I guess neither of us have the knowledge to really solve that particular problem. Anyway, are there any other transgender related issues that you wanted to bring up in this, in what's an interesting discussion?
Yeah, I just have to say, like, as a woman, as a cisgender woman, I don't feel threatened by transgender people. But, some of them are despicable people, but overall, they're human beings like all of us. And when we're talking about transgender issues, we need to listen to real transgender people, not the provocative ones that the media like to pick up, but just everyday transgender people, and they're just as diverse as the rest of us.
Yes, every group of people has good people and bad people and a lot in the middle, and you're right that it's the most extreme statements that tend to get picked up. And of course, the people who would like the whole thing to go away are much more likely to pick up on the extreme statements rather than the more moderate and statements that they might be able to agree with.
Definitely.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining me today, Maria.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Some interesting news this week after I taped that podcast. I talked about Castor Semenya. She was classified as a woman by the IAAF, but in their decision, they prioritized testosterone over anatomy. But now the Swiss Supreme Court has voided the IAAF decision, and she can run again. Others, notably an article in the Quillette online magazine, have classified her as a man due to her XY chromosomes. But the legal expert that did that obviously didn't know the difference between karyotype, which is what your chromosomes were programmed to do, and phenotype, what actually happened, which in her case was that she became a woman. Many intersex women have functional uteruses but don't produce viable eggs. That means that with an implanted egg, they could bear a baby, something that no man could do, nor a transgender woman. Another interesting news item, and also unexpected, is that the new governor of California, Gavin Newsom, has implied that he might veto the new bill, SB 277, which would put bureaucrats in charge of the awarding of medical exemptions to vaccines, which is the only exemption left in California. At the same time, the southern red states are putting in laws that would ban abortion except when the woman's life is in danger, or in some states, in case of rape or incest. Other states don't even allow those exemptions. Progressives mostly support mandatory vaccination, violating the doctor-patient relationship. And conservatives mostly support bans on abortion, which also violates the doctor-patient relationship. Imagine that you're a doctor and you think a woman might die if she doesn't have an abortion. You approve it, she lives, but then you are second-guessed by another doctor who says that she never would have died, and you're facing up to 99 years in jail. The logic is like the death of Savita Halappanavar in 2012. Doctors in Ireland would not approve the abortion until the obviously dying fetus was actually dead. By that time, sepsis was too advanced to save Savita. Abortion opponents might note that this directly led to the overturning of abortion laws in Ireland, a strongly Catholic country. The reality is that if the doctor-patient relationship is violated, doctors will never make dangerous decisions. They will never approve a medical vaccine exemption, and they will never approve an abortion on the basis that the woman is going to die without it. I received an email from Mary. She identifies as a lesbian, so it's somewhat related to this discussion today. She said, a group of lesbians are accusing you of indulging in homophobic rhetoric and keep asking me about your funding. I was wondering if you'd be interested in coming on the forum, you don't need to register to post, and answering the questions yourself. P.S. Keep up the good work. I think this is more due to my work with Rethinking AIDS than this radio show, but it's interesting. By the way, just for the record, I don't accept any money from Rethinking AIDS for my work as president. The organization has hardly any. If it had a lot of money, I probably would accept an honorarium. I tried to create a discussion on the bulletin board, offering to answer any questions, but found myself blocked and the discussion closed. I used a VPN, which uses a different IP address, so I could create an account and posted the offer again as a separate discussion. I found it somewhat shocking that people would want to criticize someone or an organization behind their back, and then when they politely offer to discuss, block them. I did eventually get a response, men not welcome. I pushed my luck and asked if a female member of the board of Rethinking AIDS could sit there and answer questions. And then, why not me? If I did what I said and simply answered questions and didn't abuse my position, because if I did, they could block me. But hint to those running computer systems, blocking by IP address doesn't work. If you use a VPN and you choose different servers, you can keep changing your IP address for a long time. It's also funny that this bulletin board allows people to post as guests, so they can't block them by accounts. Anyway, I have not received another response yet. Thank you for listening to episode 221 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.